Today, Veterans Radio dedicates this program to those American GIs who fought and died in the Korean War. Good morning, all. Oh, Gary Lilly. Well, this is Veterans Radio. Thank you, Kai. This is Veterans Radio coming to you from the studio of WDEO AM in Ann Arbor, Michigan, 990 AM, part of the Ave Maria Radio Network. Good morning to everybody. Today we're going to have a guest on, Paul Petraitis, who has written a book, Escape from North Korea. This man has more lives than a cat, I can tell you that. He was an 18-year-old sent to Korea in the opening days of the war, and I can't tell you, he's got this book. I'm going to get right on the air with Paul. There's so much to talk about. But first I want to say good morning, and I want to ask you how people can buy this book, Paul. Good morning, Paul Petraitis. Welcome to Veterans Radio. Good morning, Paul. My fault there. Good morning, Paul.
I'm sorry?
Good morning out there.
Good morning to you, sir. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you fine. Do you have a radio on nearby?
I do not, but okay. I could turn it off. I turned it down. Let me turn it off.
Okay, that would be good.
Okay.
Good deal. We could hear a little feedback to it. That's why I asked. Paul.
Okay.
All right. Here we go. Escape from North Korea. How can people buy this book? I put, perhaps mistakenly in the flyer, that it could be bought on Amazon.com. Can it?
It can, yes. One went to the book section and put in my name, it would be better. Spelling Paul, P-E-T, last name is P-E-T-R-E-D-I-S, as an author. And I don't know if one knows it, but titles of books cannot be copyrighted. Consequently, there are several other titles the same, Escape from North Korea, most of them written by North Koreans themselves. So mine would be better served by putting in my name, Paul Petraitis.
Okay, we're going to come. Hopefully remember to say that again at the end of the program, but you're absolutely right. I typed in Escape from North Korea, and all of a sudden several books popped up with the same title, and I had to search for yours. So, Paul Petraitis, P-E-T-R-E-D-I-S. Paul, you're a magnificent writer. Your writing paints a vivid picture, more so than anybody else that I've ever read. And as I said in the introduction, you've got more lives than a cat. How many experiences you had there that where you were one of the few survivors, it's astounding. Back in May, we had you on, and I thought we'd cover the whole book, but we only covered your first battle, the Battle of Anhui in Korea, in the very, very early weeks of the Korean War. How many escaped that battle, all told, Paul?
Totally, they sent in 235 of us into this village, and when the smoke cleared, 21 of us survived.
And you were one of four that was surrounded in a schoolhouse, which itself was surrounded by thick, high walls, like a medieval castle almost. And a Sergeant Bruner said to those of you that were left after dark, I'm leaving. Is that what he said? I'm getting out of here. And three of you followed him?
Exactly. Yeah. I might add it. That was my very first battle. I was so terrified, Mr. Lilly, that I don't think I could function.
Paul, you can call me Gary because I should be calling you Mr. Petratus. You're just such a remarkable person. You served 35 years as a sheriff after the war, did you?
Yes, about 30 years.
30 years. And only one person ever knew what you had, your experiences in the Korean War until you wrote the book, correct?
That's right, yeah. No one knew.
And, okay, if people did not hear the first program, I forget the date, May 28th, 21st, somewhere in there, the Battle of Anhui, go back and listen to it in the archives, and you'll be astounded at the experience of Paul Petratus. But, and I had a lot of people say, oh, my gosh, what an experience. But I'm going to tell you right now, that was only a precursor to what came later. Paul, how would you compare the Battle of Anhui to what happened later during the winter?
Oh, they were two different isolated incidences. By the time the winter came, I was more of a seasoned veteran, if you will, less prone to panic and more decisive. Unfortunately, the winter there was so devastating that one could not survive there. The Chinese, our opponents, the Chinese just literally froze to death as they stopped. And it was a very devastating winter.
And we'll come back to that, the Battle of Anhui. As you said, you were terrified, but what came later, I was terrified reading it. What after Anhui, you guys reached the American lines after, was it 6 days of walking?
We did, yeah. It was Sergeant Bruner that set the pace, and there was absolutely no sleeping. And we ran through the hills and mountains in the daytime, and at night we took to the main dirt roads where we made much better time. But it did take us 6 days to get back because of the wholesale retreat of the Allies.
And all that time, you were shot through and through in the left side, right?
I was. I was the only survivor of the 21, apparently. There may be one more that was wounded.
When you got back to American lines, how long were you hospitalized?
Oh, they sent me right back into battle, and then I think the day after they allowed me to take that hospital train back to Busan, where the main headquarters was in the hospital.
And did they, I assume they just, you already had a bandage on it or a field dressing, or did they put a new field dressing on?
Actually, no. You know, I just was shot. It was a flesh wound, actually, a very minor one, and I just kind of bit the bullet. Interesting thing about the hospital, though, they assumed I had been shot the day before, when actually by then it was more than a week, and my wound had pretty much healed. But they insisted on going through it again to make sure the bullet was gone, and so they had to open up old wounds, so to speak.
How did they do that?
They put a steel probe through the entrance and exited out where the bullet came out. It was incredibly painful.
So there was no anesthetic to it? They just bit the bullet, right?
Yeah, back to the Civil War days, I think.
Okay. You were put back in battle. Was there actually a battle when that first day when you got back?
We had a battle that day. They lost about 10 more out of leaving only about 10 original survivors at the time, as I recall.
Oh, geez. And then after the hospital, what did you experience? What happened? Where did you go?
Oh, they sent me back up to my company, and then we were part of what they called the Busan Perimeter, which was the only real estate the Allies had in the southeast corner of the country, and what it was a defensive perimeter around the main shipping port of Busan, and we stayed there. It was very grueling because the North Koreans were trying to break through to capture Busan, and I think that was about almost a 3-month siege, in that they attacked every night trying to break through. But they made a critical mistake by not extending all their troops at one time to break through. They went on a rampage cleaning up the rest of the country, and consequently the Allies, mostly the Americans, flooded the area with materiel and replacements, and we were able to have a defensive position there successfully.
Was your part of the line attacked very often?
I'm sorry?
Was your part of the line, the Busan perimeter, attacked very often?
It was. We were in the extreme southwest corner near the ocean, I believe, and that was our position. They sent a whole regiment, 5,000, against our one company, but we were able to successfully repel them.
The company is about 200 men, right?
I'm sorry?
The company was about 200 men?
Yes.
Attacked by 5,000.
Yes.
You were 18 years
old. They came in waves. They called it at the time the human sea, because they would just be shoulder to shoulder, running up, screaming. It was very effective psychologically, I might add.
Bugles, whistles, or was that the Chinese? Sound off with bugles and whistles while they were doing that?
They did, and horns, and it was pretty psychologically devastating, especially for all of us. We're quite young then.
You were 18, and the others around you were pretty close to the same age?
Yes, pretty much, other than the officers, who were just 3 or 4 years older than us, having gone through college as a rule first.
Okay, when the breakout came eventually from the Busan perimeter, what was your personal experience during the breakout?
We marched to, they had an amphibious landing in about the central of the South Korean peninsula called Incheon, the Incheon Landing. And so once we broke out, we had to meet up with those forces that were flooded into Incheon. And so although the fighting was fairly minimal then, the ordeal of marching sometimes 20 hours a day. It's pretty fatiguing.
I can imagine. Earlier, several years ago on Veterans Radio, I interviewed Bill Ulterstorff in a program called The Chosen Reservoir. No, it's called The Chosen Few. He was a Marine, and as a 15-year-old, he lied about his age to join the Marines, and he took part in that Incheon landing. It was quite amazing to hear his description from there and from the eyes of a 15-year-old. He's quite a short guy, so it was, there's a little guy, 15, attacking at Incheon. Amazing. You guys have the greatest admiration from me. We're talking to Paul Petraitis, who is the author of Escape from North Korea. And if you go to Amazon, look up his name, search by his name, because there are several books with the same name. And Paul Petraitis, P-E-T-R-I-D-I-S. You will want this book. It is the most astounding book with the best descriptions of what took place that I believe I have ever read. And I have read hundreds and hundreds of books. And so, Paul, you had the North Koreans on the run then. How far did you go?
Well, our particular unit was mostly on the west coast of the peninsula. The Marines and several American divisions were on the east, and we were separated by a geological phenomena called the Gap, a huge mountain chain that kept us from being a unified line. And so there were actually two wars at the time. The Marines engaged in a entirely different one than the Eighth Army, of which I belonged at the time.
In the last segment, we're going to get into the research that you did and the opinions that you offer up. So when you talk, it's a well-informed commentary, not just about your experiences, but about what was taking place overall during the Korean War. Paul, you said you had some minor skirmishes on the way north. What would they be like?
Actually, fairly insignificant in terms of fighting the war, because the brutal time was at the very beginning when we thought we could not hold the perimeter. And then when the Chinese came in mass in late November of 1950, they just devastated the American Allied lines.
Okay, we're going to get into that. But first, I think you had a battle called The Hill.
That was immediately following my Sergeant Bruner, that took six of us, including him, out of the schoolyard. Actually, there were four of us, and we met two others on the way out. And so that very next day, after the 6 days of trying to get back, was that battle of Chinju Pass.
Tell us about that.
The North Koreans were waiting in ambush, and we didn't know it. And they sent us up in trucks. And as they rounded the hill and went down the other side, with tanks, we had three tanks at the time, and all these soldiers in trucks, and they opened up on them and just devastated them, shot all the tanks up and the trucks with the GIs in them, and it was a very brutal thing.
Was there any cover on the road, along the road?
None.
You were out in the open on the side of a hill?
Just there was a ditch for a water runoff that followed the base of the hill. But they were in there as well, the North Koreans.
And they used the tactic of destroying the first vehicle and the last vehicle, so there was every other vehicle was trapped?
Exactly. It was quite an organized effect by their side. They were quite on a roll at the very first part of the war.
How many were in that Americans in the Battle of Chinju Pass?
There was a battalion, and I would judge by then there were only a battalion is four companies plus some ancillary units, and my sense was everyone was about at half strength because of the draconian cutbacks of the military after World War II.
So perhaps about 400 in the battalion?
Oh, I would guess closer to 800 to 1,000 probably.
In that column, that at Hsinchu Pass, there were that many in that column?
I'm sorry?
Were there that many in the column at Hsinchu Pass?
I think so. It was because most of the other part of the battalions, the other three companies didn't sustain the fatalities that my company did because they were what they were called held in reserve at the time, and they were so far away from us they couldn't get in to help us. Although they tried to rescue us, it was two different wars by then.
Okay, so there were. It was only the. It was the first company that was ambushed, and that was your company.
Yes.
What did you personally do during that battle?
Well, we were trapped in the schoolhouse, and the walls that you described were very unique. But that's how the Koreans did it. Both. In the north and the south, for some reason they ensconced their schoolyards with very high walls.
Oh, that was...
And yet at the end there was no walls,
Paul?
Because it was a playfield for the students.
Right. Hey, Paul, that was Anhui, was it not?
It was.
Okay, at Hsinchu Pass. You were there in the lead company that got ambushed. Describe the ambush. Where were the North Koreans firing from, and what did you personally do at Hsinchu Pass?
Well, most our company was the second unit up. The first company, called Charlie Company, had trucked under the protection of the tanks up this huge mountain and then across the pass and then down where the ambush took place. And once the North Koreans opened up on them, they had been placed all along the this road, and they just kind of opened up on all of us. And so we were hiding in these, not hiding, but trying to get as much protection from this very shallow rain ditch along the road.
And they were shooting at you from both sides on the hills on both sides?
Well, on the right side was the mountain, and so they were shooting from the east across the road into us.
Okay. How did you get out of there? How did it end for you?
Well, as I recall, I didn't recall. I was pretty much traumatized and in shock. And all I remember in those days, Mr. Lilly, was that I was in the ditch and they were firing at us and all this dirt was coming down on us. And then the next thing I remembered, I was on the west side of the road in the hill firing back at them. I have no idea how I got up there. I was totally in shock in those days.
And so the battle ended. You don't remember too much about what took place then. And then you guys continued on north, right?
We did. And then the politics got in it. Around October, the Allied forces were on a roll, and the Chinese made it very clear that if American forces entered into North Korea, they would intervene to protect their borders. At the time, everybody relied on General MacArthur, whose statement was it would be the biggest slaughter in the history of warfare for the Chinese. Little did they know they were coming in anyhow. They had 400,000 of them ensconced in Manchuria, right across the border from North Korea. And
Paul,
very devastating.
At this point, I want to read from your book, and the first part describes Mao Zedong's philosophy. He was the head of the Chinese Red China. He was their commander, president, whatever, dictator. And his philosophy of battle, because he had fought against the nationalist Chinese led by Chiang Kai-shek. And then I'm going to read a couple of paragraphs about how this chapter begins, called The Chinese Card. In order to draw an enemy into a fight unfavorable to him, but favorable to us, we should often engage him when he is on the move and should look for conditions favorable to ourselves and the advantageousness of the terrain and fatigue and advertence on the part of the enemy. This means that we should allow the enemy to penetrate deep, Mao Zedong. And this was in the very cold winter, which happened to be the coldest winter in the history of Korea, when temperatures hit 40 and 50 degrees below zero. You were in that winter when this took place. You had marched, your all-Americans had marched to the point of exhaustion, and you were on the side of a hill continuing your march, and at night you would try to dig in, but the frost was over a foot deep, and so you could not dig very much, and many Americans did not. So now I'm going to read what took place, and then you'll pick it up. Here's from the book. "They're here," I whispered to Bill Pierce, the BAR man with whom I shared the foxhole. "Damn it, don't you think I can hear?" he hissed in irritation. His response sounded as if he wanted to fault me for the approaching enemy. "Don't blame me. I didn't invite them," I retorted in the same whisper. I was angry, but it was realized that we were exhausted, freezing, unfed, and nerves were frayed. Besides, the Chinese didn't arrive with a brass band preceding them, announcing their arrival, as did the North Korean People's Army. These new fighters, those now in front of our line, arrived silently, and only in their sheer numbers gave their presence away. This night would not be a cakewalk. Paul, we've got about a minute. Tell us the early assault by the Chinese, and then we'll pick it up again in the next break.
Thank you. They emanated the Russian type of attack, which was full speed ahead, more or less. And because they were influenced very much by Russia at the time, who actually sanctioned the war from the very first. And so their method was pretty much the same as the North Koreans, by flooding the area with soldiers, although they were much quieter than the North Koreans, who used sound and noises as a psychological ploy against us. It really worked, too.
So this was a moonlit night, and you could see the enemy silently coming at you in swarm after swarm after swarm before the attack.
Exactly. And yeah, it was a harvest moon. I'll never forget that. It was like a flare that was hanging up in the sky. The moon didn't help them at all.
And we're reaching the end of this segment. We're talking to Paul Petratus, who writes of his, not adventures, you wouldn't call it an adventure, in the early days of the Korean War as an 18-year-old. Escape from North Korea. You can go to Amazon and type in his name, and we'll be right back.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Private First Class Melvin Brown, out of ammunition, used his entrenching tool to defend his position. Details after this.
There's always a moment of truth where I say, look, it's either put up or shut up. And it was time to put up. I had crossed that thin line. It was 100 plus degrees. We were hot. We were on fire. We were yelling our hearts out. You could feel the intensity rising. Even in our tiredness, even in our weakness, even in our pain, we continued to push. I told myself, you can suck up the pain for another mile and a half, and you will be a Marine. Not many people believe that I could do it. I don't know where I got the energy from. I don't know where the pain went to. But all I know is that I had what it took. I am a United States Marine.
AFC Darrell Willis proved he could be one of us. Can you? Call 1-800-MARINES. Maybe you could be one of the few and the proud.
While his platoon was securing Hill 755, the North Koreans counterattacked. Taking a position on a 50-foot-high wall, Brown delivered heavy rifle fire on the enemy. His ammunition was soon expended, and although wounded, he remained at his post and threw his few grenades. When his supply of grenades was exhausted, his comrades from nearby foxholes tossed others to him, and he left his position, braving a hail of fire, to retrieve and throw them at the enemy. The attackers continued their assault, and Brown, weaponless, drew his entrenching tool from his pack and calmly waited until they peered over the wall, delivering each a crushing blow on the head. Brown's daring action so inspired his platoon that they repelled the attack and held their position. Brown was reported killed in action September 5, 1950. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Iraq, Afghanistan, and other qualified veterans, your country needed you. Now the veterans of foreign wars need you. The VFW is not an organization where members sit around and tell war stories. We are advocates for those who serve. We fought for the new GI Bill, and you can be part of our next win. We are your peers, and we want you to be one of us. Your membership is free the first year, so contact Graf O'Hara Post 423 at VFW423.org. That's VFW423.org.
And we're back on Veterans Radio with our guest Paul Petraitis, whose book Escape from North Korea is one of the most astounding books I've ever read out of hundreds of books about the World War II, Korea, Vietnam War. And Paul Petraitis, his last name is spelled P-E-T-R-E-D-I-S. I cannot recommend this book enough. Go to Amazon and type in his name. Paul, there is so much in this thick book of the things that you experienced, but we're going to just simply talk about that one night, and we're going to leave the politics out of it and the strategy out of it. We're going to talk about the grunt on the ground, and then in the last segment, we'll talk about some of what your research turned up. So the enemy attacked, and you guys, you and the BAR man were in a hole big, just barely big enough to carry the fit the both of you in there, and it was about 18 inches deep. Describe what happened, the terrain in front of you where the Chinese came through, and describe what happened and how the line, company line, was laid out, please.
As we moved north through this mountain range, we were very separated from each other, and each night we would try to, we were ordered to dig in, but again, as you mentioned, it was impossible because of the cold. But we noticed the North Koreans or the Chinese had dug their own foxholes that we would see as we moved up. What they did, and it was very unique, is they all got in one huge defensive line, and then they kept moving back, and the powers to be presumed that they were retreating, when in fact they were luring us all into this thing where they attacked all at one time by the hundreds of thousands.
So they were preparing for the counterattack, and those foxholes were dug not to be used that night, but to be used in the future.
I would presume that their thought was they would all line up, and then when everyone was in one unified line, they would attack, which they did. It was November 27th, Korea time, when they attacked through the whole line. I read some narratives about it, and it was so devastating because they just ran over the Allies that night, and it was just chaos.
We're gonna spend about 6 minutes talking about you in the foxhole and the BAR man next to you. Describe the assault.
It was similar, as I mentioned, to the North Koreans, but quiet. They didn't scream or yell. They had very primitive communications then, and they used a lot of fireworks that normally imbue nostalgia for our Independence Day, but in this case they used them for signals, as well as audio things such as ram's horns and trumpets and things of that nature.
How cold was it that night?
Oh, my God, I couldn't believe it. It was, they said it was 40 below zero. I had to take my mittens off to load up these magazines for the barman to use. The bar stands for Browning Automatic Rifle. It was kind of a submachine gun in a way,
right.
More portable. But boy, did it burn up the rounds in no time at all.
There were 20 round magazines, and at one point you had to stop firing your rifle and just reload magazines for the BAR man.
Right.
You took
and
your.
I couldn't do it with my mittens on. Because it was too difficult to do, so what I did was took my mitten off and tried to load them up.
Reloading a magazine is hard on the ends of the fingers when it's warm in the summertime. How was it at 40 below that you were reloading those metal magazines with brass rounds?
Oh, I'll never forget that night. It was so cold. It was cold for everyone, and even the Chinese, because they had just lightweight canvas shoes, kind of like tennis shoes in a way, and I don't know how they survived, but they had a huge loss to frostbite, as well as the American side.
I remember you, in the book, you told the BAR man to quit burning up the ammunition so fast.
Yeah, I remember that. And he said, tell it to them. But he did keep them away from our side of the perimeter. That was the first assault that I could ever recall that we couldn't see our fellow officers. We were spread that thin. And it wasn't until years later that I found out they had actually, the enemy penetrated our perimeter. And then our company commander at the time took a couple soldiers and they killed these intruders that came into our perimeter, so we were able to hold them off. But then again, I didn't realize at the time the fatalities we suffered. About one-third of the company was killed that night.
The company would have been about 200 in size, would it?
Yes.
And how many?
Exactly.
How many Chinese do you think were attacking you that night?
That attacked us?
Correct. Yes.
Oh, I would guess another regiment, thousands of them. They made a head count the next morning before we retreated out. And there were close to, as I recall, 400 bodies right that the BAR man had killed right in front of our perimeter at the bottom of the hill.
So you and your BAR man and mostly the BAR killed about 400 Chinese that night.
Yes. That was easy to do because there were so many of them. They were just shoulder to shoulder again.
You had two rifle grenades.
I did, yes.
They were meant to be used.
I fired those off. As I mentioned in the book, they're meant to be used as mortars in that you would put the butt of the rifle on the ground, and when you fired off the grenades, they would just lob in the air, and it was kind of a hit-or-miss type thing. Very inaccurate and all that, but I had to fire from the shoulder because of the way the ground was situated, and it was a kick like a mule, but I survived it.
You fired at Chinese that were forming for more attacks, so they were in quite a mass, and you saw that that was the perfect time to use those two grenades that were so heavy and use them on a mass of enemies. That's why you fired from the shoulder, right?
Yes, exactly.
You were up a hill a little bit, and they had to come up a draw in front of you at your fighting position.
Yeah.
So they were clumped up in big groups. And
oh, absolutely, yeah. Their undoing was this bright moon out. They would have liked to have that not there. So that was really an advantage to us because we could see them.
Real quick, geez, we only have a minute and a half left. The following day, you started to pull back, and you talked about an observation plane that flew overhead and dropped notes to every battalion commander along its route. What did those notes say?
They said there were so many enemy soldiers that it looked like the ground was moving. And then they advised everybody to get out. But by then, everyone knew it. We were just absolutely devastated. And in fact, we evacuated, retreated, if you will, totally out of North Korea in about a 2-week period. They just realized the American forces that we were lost then. And although they've papered it over the years and ignored it, the facts are that the Chinese devastated the Allied lines.
Just one real quick comment from you, please. When you were in your fighting hole, pardon me, when you were in your fighting hole, you said you couldn't see the other fighting holes, but you could only see the flash in the air from their weapons being fired.
Exactly, yeah.
That's how thinly you were spread out.
We were very well spread out because it was a repeat, it seemed like, for about 2 weeks.
Okay, we're coming up on the break, Paul. Paul, we'll pick it up again. We'll be right back.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
And we're back on Veterans Radio with Paul Petritis, who wrote a book, Escape from North Korea, describing greatly the experiences he had as an 18-year-old in the early days of the Korean War, which was just brutal, especially to our troops. But, Paul, in your book, there's a bibliography of about 20 of books that you read to research what took place. And you've got part two in the book, and that pretty much describes what the Chinese were doing, what the Americans were doing, and what the thought process appeared to be of the different leaders on both sides. How did you happen to get started writing after so many years?
Well, thank you for that, Mr. Lilly. The reason I wrote it is because my psychological, emotional frame was breaking down. I didn't realize the devastating effects of post-traumatic stress disorder, and they didn't either at the time, the therapists, until the Vietnam War occurred, and then it all came to light as to the devastation it does to one's mind. And so I wrote it primarily as a catharsis. I could never retrieve the monies I spent to put this together, but by the same token, I didn't do it for a profit-making thing. I did it to save my soul, so to speak. And
along the way, Paul, and this is so magnificent, you told the story of those who cannot tell the story. Those who died and those who are in the same mental state as you, who can't put it in writing and who can't speak of it as well as you do with such description, if they can speak of it at all.
Well, I appreciate that.
What was the politics there? You give a very devastating think opinion of General MacArthur. Tell us what you came to realize during that period of time.
We made a lot of mistakes after World War II, in my view, starting with the UN that, as you know, is headquartered in New York. It would seem to me that if it was truly a UN, it should have been in Switzerland, in a neutral country that respected all nationalities. Because we were so powerful after World War II, compared to the rest of the world that was devastated by bombs and their populations wiped out, we survived quite well. Other than the death of American soldiers. But economically, it brought us out of the Great Depression and so on and so forth. And so consequently, we ruled the UN, I'm sorry to say, but that's exactly what it was. And we successfully kept Red China out of the UN, even though they defeated Chiang Kai-shek's forces in China, the true ruling class of China then was the Communist Party, and wrong or right, Russia was in the UN and the rest. But I think that was one of the most erroneous things we did, by not engaging in dialogue with the Chinese.
What is your opinion on MacArthur? You put it pretty bluntly in your book.
I did, and I didn't do it with malice aforethought, if you will. I did it based on the records of reading all of the things, and he was a Polynesian type of leader, in that no one would speak up against him, and he had an ego that just was beyond comprehensive, and he just took on the whole administration and decided for himself. And that was part of the situation, in my view, of why they call it the Forgotten War, simply because everyone relied on MacArthur, and then the Chinese did it different.
You write in your book that the Chinese had warned over and over again not to approach the Yalu, which was the Yalu River, which was the separation between North Korea and Manchuria, China. But you feel that MacArthur's ego was such that he wanted to go out with a bang. He wanted one last big hurrah.
Absolutely, and Truman quite correctly wanted to keep it as a local regional conflict. And in fact, by then they wanted the Americans, speaking for all the Allies, wanted out from that debacle. Particularly at the time, there was strong belief that Stalin would want to move into Eastern Europe while we were tied down in Korea. And I think Bradley, Omar Bradley, then the chief of staff of the forces, said, you know, this is a wrong war at the wrong time with the wrong enemy, and he was very clear about that we ought to get out of that Korean mess.
And it went on for another 3 years, 4 years?
It did, and it was because no one talked. Very few people, and I don't mean to sound pompous about it, but I've read so much that what had happened was the Chinese didn't believe in prisoners of war. They called them deserters, and millions of nationalist troops surrendered to Mao's communist troops during their civil war that ended in 1949, and Mao was going to put them all against the Allies in Korea, because he didn't care what happened to them either way. What really ended the war was, that few people know it, was the death of Stalin in March of 1953. Khrushchev took over, and actually he was quite a peacemaker at the time, and he wanted to end the war because he wanted better relations with the West. And so they kind of told Mao, who they had some influence over at the time, that the war is over. And had it not been for Stalin dying and Khrushchev changing everything, why who knows what would have happened there.
Paul, I want to end this. Hopefully I can get it in with a poem written by one of the members of my Vietnam Veterans of America chapter. It's called Korea, the Forgotten Men. The Forgotten War, they call it, in the face of you good men. We'll pretend it never happened and never speak of it again. We'll forget the 54,000 killed, the 300,000 wounded or maimed. We'll cut it out of our history books and never speak of it again. But there are nearly 8,000 missing, and the families remember their names, and nearly a million that served there, that came home, and were never the same. To pretend it never happened and never speak of it again. Finally, some 60 years later, we stand and salute you men. We'll raise a flag and drink a toast to wars forgotten, and then we'll welcome you home and shake your hands. It's okay for hugs and tears. Then we'll hang our heads in humble shame because it took some 60 years. It's time that we said thank you for what you did back then, to say welcome home and God bless you, then to speak of it again and again, of the honorable men who fought that war, never to be forgotten again. Welcome home. And Paul Petratus, welcome home, and thank you for being our guest on Veterans Radio. Tune in again next week for another enthralling story of the people that have kept this country free, and to that extent, the rest of the world. Until then, you are dismissed.
Opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily of Veterans Radio or of this station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio Network.